Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
We have seen the condition improve now to just 21% very poor to poor, an 11-point improvement over the last 5 weeks.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey looking at wheat conditions.
At the same time, winter wheat in Kansas rated good to excellent increased 11 percentage points from 32 to 43%. We also saw some improvement in Oklahoma. The big jump there was actually in the good to excellent categories.
But in the north,
it has been warm, it has been rather dry, and we've seen a bit of erosion of the condition there. Montana winter wheat rated good to excellent, dropping 15 percentage points over the last 5 weeks from 58 to 43% good to excellent. At the same time, winter wheat in Montana rated very poor to poor has jumped from 5 to 21%.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
To me, a soft landing is the economy continues to grow, the labor market remains strong, and inflation comes down. And I believe that's the path we're on.
That's what she expects to see on a soft landing, Secretary of the Treasury Janet Yellen, on what is a soft landing that's been promoted by the Federal Reserve. That's one side of the equation. The other is selling products through trade. And China.
So I see a three-part agenda with respect to China. The first is that we want to have a relationship that involves healthy competition, trade, investment that is broadly beneficial both to the United States and to China. Is good for businesses. China is a huge market and is good for American workers, creates jobs. So we do not want to decouple. The Biden administration does not seek to decouple from China, but we do seek to de-risk. And that means we don't want to be overly dependent when it comes to key supply chains on China. Instead, I've promoted an approach called friendshoring, which involves diversifying our supply chains. And we're working with India, Vietnam, with Mexico, with Indonesia, with other countries to continue to get the benefits of international trade, but to be less reliant on China. We also need a level playing field, and the president in his meeting with Xi, and I met a few days before that with my Chinese counterpart. China has practices that, result in unfair trade, subsidies, intellectual property practices that create an unlevel playing field that we intend to address, but no decoupling. And continued engagement, that's plank one. Plank two, we're going to protect our national security and speak out about human rights. And there's no compromising about that. But we'll try to make our approach as narrow, as targeted as we possibly can. And I'd say the recent rules that we put forward with respect to outbound investment, where we do see some dangers of U.S. firms investing in China, are very narrowly targeted at advanced semiconductors, artificial intelligence, quantum computing, and with real national security implications. And the third plank of the China policy is we need to cooperate to address global challenges. We have a responsibility to the world to do that. Two areas that are very important are climate change and debt, that there are a lot of countries around the world are really suffering, especially with high interest rates, from unsustainable debt burdens. They need to restructure their debt, and we need to cooperate to do it. And China is one of the biggest lenders. So we need to work. This isn't a U.S.-China issue. It's a multilateral issue. But we are in regular conversations with our Chinese counterparts to try to make progress in these areas. And I feel encouraged by the signs that things are getting better.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
It is important to note that we have active discussions with market participants about the migration process, and so definitely welcome any questions or feedback from this group.
Suzanne Sprague is with the CME Group, talking about changes to margins and how they'll be calculated.
Every set of market participants is important to that migration schedule, and so for us, communication is key and making sure we're accounting for any additional factors specific to those asset classes is very important. So again, we take that migration process very seriously and welcome engagement from you folks as well as we think through migrating for that process. It is very early days for the agricultural markets, but it's never too early to start thinking about what factors might need to be considered. So we are starting to have those discussions about our migration for the agricultural products, even though we're a few years away from that.
Sprague, recently at a CFTC ag hearing, Jeff Reardon is with White Commercial Corporation.
So if you're talking about a large co-op to us, it's a small co-op in the marketplace. What our largest customers are, if you go through a town and you see a farmer-owned cooperative, most likely the cooperative is going to have the town name. Okay, so that's, you know, that's a sign that they may be working with White Commercial. And the banks that they work with, believe it or not, it's going to be a banking syndication. So you're going to have Farm Credit is most likely going to be one of the leaders there. And there will be multiple banks that work with them. Now, those folks are going to understand, deeply understand the need for the capital. So part of that stress test is going to be this initial margin requirement, which I'll talk to in a second. Now, the second tranche of our customer base, well, they're not going to have the town name most likely on their elevator. What they're going to have is their name, right? Because it's an independent, maybe multi-generational company that it's, you know, Smith or whoever their name is going to be part of that organization. Now, with them, their banking relationship is going to be a little bit different in that it's probably going to be a regional bank. It may be Farm Credit, but it may be a regional bank that they work with. And, you know, for a situation like we're looking at, and I'll talk to, is, you know, they're, by changing the initial margin requirement, and we're talking about rice now, not corn, beans, and wheat. But for rice, if you're a rice farmer and you're in Arkansas, we changed our initial margin from $750, basically on the right side, all the way up to basically $3,700. So it's a $3,000 change per contract. So for them, you know, they've, like I said, they've got their name on the door. You know, they're probably looking at about $1.5 million to $2 million in initial margin. You know, so this isn't a small amount, you know, to them. And we, believe me, we need this protection in the market. But you can see how quickly that the protection was needed. So there's a lot of money to anybody, but definitely to our customer base. And finally, the last tranche of our customer is that smaller farmer, and all of them are trying to protect against price risk. And when the market gets volatile, you know, it could be $50,000 to them or $100,000, which is, once again, it's all related to the balance sheet that you have. And in that case, that may keep them out of the market. Right? They may have to go somewhere else other than the futures market if it's going to be, you know, $50,000 or $100,000 to get in. But for our customer base, you know, this is a big move. And like you said earlier, it was almost unprecedented to see a move this big. But the initial margins do affect us. It's money that we have to put in. That's our skin in the game. And so with our customer base as it is, and one of my associates, Jason Wheeler, was with the Rice Federation. He asked me to come and talk to that because I'm intimately involved in the financial structure, you know, for that part of the agricultural community.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
It's definitely much more optimistic than it has been the last 2 years. At least over a majority of our winter wheat is not in a D3 or D4 drought like it has been.
Chandler Gould is CEO of the National Association of Wheat Growers, says 24 starts off better than most other years.
Earlier, I was speaking to some of our Oklahoma growers that actually said their winter wheat was a little taller than they had expected it to be this year. So hopefully we are moving out of this drought cycle and can have a couple good years of good production.
Good news for those producers looking to graze the wheat. But when it comes to cattle, Allison Rivera, National Cattlemen's Beef Association, talks about a new pilot program.
Information about this came out about maybe a month and a half ago, so very new. I think this just goes along the lines of in this space where NCBA has been trying to work with USDA, not only for more tools in the toolbox in the risk management space for cattle producers, but specifically maybe more, you know, cow-calf producers. And again, a lot of the work we've been doing is trying to educate producers of the programs that are out there that are available. You know, there's a lot of programs out there under that risk management title. And so we just want to make sure that producers know that there are programs available. This program is very new, so new that we are going to have those who are selling this new pilot program come speak to the Ag and Food Policy Committee meeting at our convention, our NCBA convention in late January, so that producers have the ability to ask very specific questions about this. It is a four-state pilot program, and, you know, I think that it being a new tool specifically for the cow-calf producers out there, we're excited that, you know, there's a new tool out there. So looking forward to kind of diving deeper into this program and making sure that everybody has the correct information on it.
This new pilot program, officially called Weaned Calf Risk Protection.
I think it's specifically an insurance option for our cow-calf producers. Again, four states designed to protect the profitability of their spring calving. We know that weather is going to continue. We know that bad weather is going to continue. And so I think this is just another opportunity for that risk management. The protection would ensure that it would insure producers against their calves declining in price due to decreased weaning weight caused by things like drought, which we, you know, right now we're seeing a pretty bad drought in the South, in Louisiana, Alabama, Mississippi areas. So excessive moisture, hail, wind, frost, insects, disease, you name it. So as we continue to face more environmental challenges, hard winters in particular, flooding, this is just going to be another tool to protect those cow-calf producers.
Again, it's a pilot program for 2024 for four states.
Colorado, Nebraska, South Dakota, and Texas. And that was a very important question. So, you know, I'm sure a lot of your listeners were keen on what states those are. And again, Colorado, Nebraska, South Dakota, and Texas. And again, in a pilot form, you know, USDA will gather information about how the program is being used, whether it's working. And then as they do with a lot of pilot programs, if it's successful, then we can work with them to expand the coverage for further states.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
It certainly takes skill on the part of the Fed to calibrate monetary policy properly.
Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen on the Fed actually executing a soft landing for the economy.
But if you just look at the data, it looks as though that's the path we're on. And I will say that for the last several years, what I've been saying when asked about the economy is that I believe it's possible to have a soft landing, that there's nothing inherent about the shocks that have hit the economy that make it necessary to have a period of high unemployment to get inflation down. So many economists were saying there's no way for inflation to get back to normal without its entailing a period of high unemployment, a recession. And a year ago, I think many economists were saying a recession was inevitable. But actually, I've never felt there was a solid intellectual basis for making such a prediction, because as long as inflation, I mean, the times when you've, in the United States, in a sense, needed a downturn to get inflation down, those were periods like after the oil shocks of the 70s, when inflation expectations were clearly had moved much higher. And inflation then becomes self-perpetuating. You have a wage-price spiral that really the only way to bring inflation down is getting inflation expectations down, and that involves a period of high unemployment that pushes inflation down and shows people you were wrong, inflation's actually lower than you thought. That's a painful process. We didn't need that. And because inflation expectations had never meaningfully ratcheted up on a long-term basis, we just had to have the economy normalize and get the labor market back to a sort of full employment state to bring inflation down. Now, of course, there were shocks along the way. Russia's invasion of Ukraine led to soaring food and energy prices that had, that of course boosted inflation and had the potential to dislodge inflation expectations. So there have been many risks along the way, but we've managed to avoid the adverse real consequences of those risks. And I think we're on a soft landing path, which is highly desirable, of course.
She's been the head of the Fed and now the Treasury. What's the difference between the two?
The Fed's job is very focused, mainly on, supervision, of course, is an important piece of the Fed's job. But with respect to the economy, it's focusing on constructing a monetary policy that best allows attainment of a price stability, maximum employment mandate. The Treasury's jobs are very, very broad. I've never been in a position where the responsibilities are so diverse. We have 1,000 people who work at Treasury who deal with sanctions and threats to, from terrorist financing, illicit finance. We have tax policy, international economic relations with a variety of countries, represent the United States in the multilateral development banks and the IMF, and on and on. So the range of responsibilities at Treasury is really enormous.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Basically, you get a fecal sample at the time you use your product, and then go back and like Mark said a while ago, about 14 days later, it's very critical that you don't go under that 14 days and then you don't exceed it very much, because what you're trying to find out is actually how effective it was on that animal.
It's been growing concern on the problem of increasing parasite resistance in cattle. Dr. Tom Hargrove is a Texas A&M beef specialist talking about how to sample.
If you would sort of go out, say, 30 days, then you might pick up a few parasites on the pasture, which might kind of mess up your data. So, again, that's the most effective. And we're doing a pretty thorough deal on this. So we're taking 20 animals out of each class, 20 cows, 20 calves, and if possible, 21st calf heifers or young bulls. Now, young bulls, if you're developing bulls or purchasing young bulls, they tend to have more issues with parasites. So internal parasites, in other words, they tend to be more likely to be wormy, I guess we could say it that way. And then again, first calf heifers, when they're going through the stress of trying to deliver that first calf, a lot of times parasites are going to be a big issue in first calf heifers. They're going to carry a pretty good load. So those are two classes that you really want to stay on top of, and your calves. And if you can get your calves, you know, they need to be at least 60 days. Because the only way they're going to be getting these worms is pick them back up off what they're eating, what they're grazing the forage. And so if you go in there and you're trying to sample some wet needle calves, you're not going to get any information. I personally like to wait about 90 days. That ensures that they're consuming forage pretty good and have been on it a little while.
So that's how to sample, but when should you sample?
When we get into the late fall, early winter would be a better time to sample. As a rule, early in the spring, or late in the spring, not early, is, you know, especially if you're spring calvers, when those calves are getting a little age on them, maybe at branding, depending, would be probably a good time to sample calves. And again, there's the eggs out of these parasites, and there's about four or five different species of parasites. The eggs look the same, right? So I can't tell the difference just looking at that egg, what particular parasite it is. So with this project, and we're taking and we're sending those at these samples are also going to Colorado State so they can speciate those. So we'll know if we've got Ostertagia and Muncas, you know, what type of parasites we have in there. Now playing the likelihood, if you've got pre-weaned calves, then those parasites, you would expect more parasites because cattle do develop some immunity. Now it's not total immunity and protective immunity, but your cows are less likely to be carrying a heavy parasite load because they've picked up worms over time and they've built some immunity. Again, it's not total, but it means a lot. Those calves haven't had time to pick up, you know, to develop immunity, have an immune response. So it's real important to get up that, and that's where you're going to save a lot of money from a worming program if you can get those calves cleaned out. I mean, they're going to gain better.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Many of you may be familiar that we post margin levels on our website for the major products and the major asset classes. We'll continue to do that for Span 2. We are doing that currently for the energy products.
At the December CFTC Ag Advisory Committee meeting, Suzanne Sprague with the CME Group talked about the importance of transparency, especially when setting margins.
And then we do provide a variety of tools that customers can use to be able to do margin analysis themselves to ensure that for existing portfolios or hypothetical portfolios, there's an understanding of what the margin levels look like for a given product or portfolio.
The event's usually 2 or 3 days, and CFTC Commissioner Christy Goldsmith Romero said,
"I've really benefited from hearing directly from you, directly from our ag sector, not just the challenges that you face, but the pride you have in what you make, what you deliver, and all of your on-the-ground experiences has really helped. It's one thing to hear about transportation or labor issues, and it's another to like be there watching that all of a sudden the train showed up super late and you know they're trying to pull people in to fill it, and I was able to see that. It's also, you know, a situation where when we talk about input costs and labor costs, being on the ground and being able to see it is really helpful. But I also really appreciate that people reach out. And we have these meetings in Washington too, and then also on Zoom, because I do listen, I do input that. I encourage you to reach out to me. I want to start 2024 hearing from everyone, particularly in the ag sector, about what the issues are so we can plan for the next year. And I also, not just the challenges, but the excitement about what you're doing. It's fascinating to me to go in there and actually, you know, learn about sorting soybeans for Japanese customers that want like uniform color, and actually sit there with them in my hand and sort of understanding that. And I never knew there was so much to learn about oils. I know a lot more. Importantly, you really drive the economy. And I was at Treasury for 12 years, so I tend to look at things through the lens of how it relates to our economy. And so my highest priority has always been that these derivatives markets are working well, particularly for you. I think the derivatives markets can play a critical role in the economy too. We need to stabilize prices. We've got to deal with volatility, particularly as these geopolitical issues come up. So I think 2023, the derivatives markets have worked really well under some significant stresses. So I really look forward to these presentations about Ukraine and Russia and Ukraine and the other geopolitical events. We've been tracking, and I look every day at those wheat prices, and I really rely on our economists who do a good job of bringing other data in, whether it's from USDA or wherever, and we're making analysis. That is something we do every single day. I do not have a day where I do not do that. That is the start of my day. It's usually also in the afternoon, so it's twice a day for me every day that I've been in this job. I never lose sight of that. And even when we have emerging issues or technology, you might hear speeches. my day-to-day work is monitoring those markets.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
The alphabetical listing starts with Arizona at 41%, very short to short. Goes on through Colorado at 45%, Indiana 40%, Kansas 47%, Louisiana at 64%, very short to short, Mississippi 52%, Montana at 79%, Nebraska 52%, Nevada 55%, New Mexico leading the nation at 82%, very short to short, Tennessee 44%, and Wyoming to finish the list, 46%, very short to short.
Talking pasture and rangeland conditions, USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey.
So that is a reflection of some of the lingering drought across the Great Plains. And also, as you move to the western U.S., the lack of general storminess that we've seen this season, leading to some surface drying in states that had been quite wet until recently. Also, dealing with the ongoing drought conditions in parts of the southeast and lower Midwest.